and I see the values that they're instilling in their children, and they're very similar. It's about family. It's about rooting for each other and, you know, raising people that you can count on.
Welcome to The Art of Fatherhood, a podcast that takes you on the journey of fatherhood. Now here's your host, Art Eddy.
This week's The Art of Fatherhood podcast is being brought to you by Gladly Family. Make sure you use the code The Art of Fatherhood for 20% off your order. One of the things we talk about here in The Art of Fatherhood podcast is being prepared as a parent. When your first child arrives, there are so many things being thrown out at you. Being prepared when it comes to your baby will help you out big time. Trust me on this. This is where Gladly Family comes into play. They offer practical, thoughtfully designed, and dependable products that offer tremendous value to new families. From all-terrain stroller wagons like the Anthem 2 and Anthem 4 stroller wagons that combine style and performance to the Merit Play Yard that can be used from birth and beyond. The Gladly Family also has a fantastic pod diaper bag that has a changing station and a travel cot that allows you to bring everything you need, plus space for your baby to get changed safely or take a snooze wherever you and your baby go. How cool is that, right? Talk about being prepared. The Gladly Family believes that families have enough on their plate, so they don't want families to overpay for gear and end up with less features. You're buying products for your child. You want quality. You want products that are easy to use. You want products that are durable. So if you're a new parent, make sure you go to gladlyfamily.com to check out the Merit Play Yard, the Pod Diaper Bag, and the Anthem 2 and Anthem 4 stroller wagons, and so much more. Check out all those products at gladlyfamily.com. Make sure you use the code Art of Fatherhood for 20% off your order when you go to gladlyfamily.com. That's gladly, G-L-A-D-L-Y, family.com. What's going on, everybody? Art Eddy here for another edition of the Art of Fatherhood podcast, and I'm very honored to have the one and only Alan Zweibel. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic, man. I'm on cloud nine. A lot of the stuff that you have worked on, have done, I grew up on, and we're going to be talking about a bunch of other great things, but love chatting with good guys like yourself about fatherhood. So I know you got kids and grandkids, but take me back when you found out you were going to be a dad. What was going through your mind, sir?
Well, I met my wife. We were both working on Saturday Night Live. I was a writer. She was a production assistant. We started dating. We got married. And, you know, back then, we had the choice whether she got pregnant. We knew she was pregnant because she had a job on a TV show called Kids Are People Too. And she kept on falling asleep at her desk. And she got in trouble. They were going to fire her. And she was pregnant. It was glorious. It was, you know, I was a little nervous, as I guess most dads for the first time are. But, and we didn't want to know what the sex was. We have two other children that came afterwards. And well, all right, you know, if the nurse knows or if it's written in the drawer somewhere, fine, we might as well know. But we kept this, we were in the dark. We went to Lenox Hill Hospital here in New York. And oh, it was great because he was born October 11th, 1981. And if you look it up, the Dodgers were playing the Yankees in the World Series. So between contractions, the doctors left the room to go watch the World Series. And I'm going, wait a second, because I also wanted to watch the World Series. But I'm going, no, that would look really bad. You know, that could be, and it was a boy. And his name was Adam. It was the greatest, you know. It's, you know, the first time we played roly-poly, the first time I took him to a ball game, you know, being that kind of dad and sports oriented. And then the next two kids were girls, and we now have five grandchildren. And my wife Robin and I were now married. November will be 43 years.
Congratulations!
Thank you. They're out. You know, for those of you who bet the under, you lost. All right, sorry. I'm very, very sorry. But they're our lives. We moved from LA back to New Jersey. My wife's from Jersey. I'm originally from Long Island, and because our kids are here, they moved here. They were brought up in LA. They sort of leaned in the East Coast direction. So we didn't want to be absentee parents or grandparents. So here we are.
Kudos to you, sir. You know, one of the things I always say, and I'll be asking you like this in a second about like an advice for new dads, but the fact that you guys are there with your kids, it's always great to have parents there as a resource and just as a backup plan and be like, hey, something came up. We both have our jobs. You mind helping out? But to have someone there for you that they love and trust and they can count on speaks volumes. So kudos to you guys for doing
Thank
that.
you. Thank you. You know, we take pride in that. And you know something, what's really cool about it is we recognize the fact that we're in the second row. Okay. So, all right. So we're spectators. And to watch your children be parents is a fascinating thing because within a millisecond, let's say a kid, one of the kids are naughty. Okay. And you see how your kid handles it. It's as if to say, okay, when I did that, my parents did that. Oh, I hated that. So I'll do that. Okay. So they're auditing what took place. You know,
But you can be, well, Alan, but you can be honest though too, right? So you can, you know, you see your kids having to deal with, you know, your grandkids like acting up and all this other stuff, and like, ah, karma, how's
Oh
that
yeah, it's that thing where my pit mother would always say, "A wish for me was to have a son like me." You know what I mean? Like this was the worst curse in the world, you know. So, yeah, look, it is fun because whatever they do to us is cute. Do in front of us is cute. Whereas I can understand as a parent, you know, no, don't put the dog in the fireplace. That could only lead to no good. So, you know, so the humor in it, and we don't take it home with us. You know, we enjoy it, and obviously, if there's a concern, we're around. They know where to find us. But there's a difference between, you know, interfering and being around and being available. You know, so.
Great. Yeah. Great view on that being spectators or second row. I love that. That's fantastic. You know, there's like helicopter parents, and then there's, I think the worst case scenario would be helicopter grandparents. So
Can you
well done on that.
imagine? Not only do
And
you have your own parents, but you got these old people sort of coming and telling you, you know, no, nothing could be worse than that. And you know, it's interesting because I'll go to the kids' soccer games or little league games or whatever. And at this stage, having been through it three times with our children, I can tell by looking at the parents. Oh, this is their first kid. They're too involved. They're too loud. This must be their second kid. They're involved, but you know, they're also looking at their phone. And then, you know, oh, this got to be their third or fourth kid because they haven't looked at the game once. You know what I mean? So it's a fascinating study.
So speaking of that, like, and you're a great writer, and I feel like "Don't Put the Dog in the Fireplace" is going to be one of your next books for children. I think it's going to
I
be
just
great.
wrote it down.
Yeah, but I honestly feel like, you know, since you as a writer, comedy writer, you are really good at, you know, looking at people from different angles. So you, I think the idea of empathy and making sure you see every side of it were probably some of the values you were looking to instill into your kids. But before I jump the gun and put any more values, what were some of the values you were looking to instill into your kids as they were growing up?
We brought them up in LA. Okay. Like I said, my wife and I are both from the East Coast. We met on SNL. And then I sold a show called It's Gary Shandling Show out in
Oh.
California. So that brought us to LA. And I did that show. I did a few other shows, did a few movies. So we were out there for 16 years. And we were able to, thank God, we had the means to also keep a home on the East Coast where we came back to New Jersey. That's we built a house. And sent our kids to East Coast camps. We didn't want them to be LAX. Okay, that was the word. That was the word I was asking about. Okay, and so we worked really hard at that, you know, because like our son Adam would come home, and I'll make up a name now. He'll go, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger has two pools. I go, oh, that's really nice. By the way, it's your turn to take out the garbage. I had to be that guy, you know, and I see the values that they're instilling in their children, and they're very similar. It's about family, it's about rooting for each other, and you know, raising people that you can count on.
Just like your kids can count on you to help them when you guys came back to live near their neck of the woods. I love it.
Yeah.
What is something that your kids or now even grandkids have taught you about life or about yourself that maybe you kind of knew was there, but once you had kids, you're like, man, this is a life lesson, or this is something I didn't know really about myself until I had kids.
Well, that's a wonderful question. I don't know if there's a seminal incident as much as there's something cumulative about all the cliches about how fast time passes. Okay, we had a grandson, and then he was bar mitzvahed last year. Now, how did that happen so fast? How did I turn 72? When did I turn 72? When the hell did that happen? Okay, and if you add up all that happened between when you were born and what happened, oh yeah, I guess that takes 72 years. But I think, look, we're not built to last. It's not about the material stuff. It's about the emotional stuff. I won't mention which grandparents, but there's another set of grandparents with one of our kids, and they'll buy a big birthday present for the kid. Okay, that costs $1,100, and then it's that old cliche, and then the kid plays with the box. So, wait a second. If you're going to buy him a book, sit him down and read the book with them. Have the connection made. That's what the association will be,
The another cliche is presence over presents, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's C and T. Yeah.
Love it. One more question about father, and then we're gonna kind of go into a couple other things.
Sure.
Dad hack or piece of advice you'd offer to new dads, what would it be?
Remember that you were once a kid, all right, but don't relive it through your kid. You gotta it's his turn, it's her turn. We don't get do-overs, you know what I mean? We go through it once. Hopefully, whatever you instilled will be carried on, or if you made a mistake along the way, it will be rectified. It's not an exact science because I imagine gene pools and nature, in addition to nurture, comes into play. Wow, they have five kids. They're wonderful. Four of them wonderful. The other one is an assassin. Why? How did that happen?
That was the fifth kid who saw their parents not even paying attention to their t-ball game. I'm like, oh, I'll get him back. Don't you worry.
Oh, I'll get attention now. Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. And one of the things, you mentioned also too about, being there over material things, right? And one of the
Sure.
things that you have done in your career is you've written a book called A Tree Named Steve. Book came out around 2007. I'm actually, my family and I, we live in North Carolina, so we experienced not like the huge brunt of Florida's brunt of the Hurricane Ian, but you saw someone on their Instagram post just talked about this book, A Tree Named Steve, that you wrote, and it meant a lot to them. And especially for you as a writer, as especially as a joke writer, working on Saturday Night Live, working on the Gary Shandling Show, Curb Your Enthusiasm, all that good stuff, you see people's reaction. But I think this one hits a little bit harder and more emotional and deeper, just because the book you wrote, it was talking about family and what's important. And for this woman to, do an Instagram post must have meant a lot to you, right?
Oh my God, I've been very lucky. And so look, a lot of things didn't work, but a lot of things I was lucky enough that they hit,
Yeah.
I mean, I would say of the 11 books that I've written, the two that it's interesting, the two that have gotten the best, not only reviews, but sales and have been embraced and have been endured, was a book I wrote about me and Gilda Radner called Bunny Bunny, which was about our relationship. Because there was something universal about it. There was this platonic 14-year love story. And yeah, certainly was helped by the fact that this was a well-known person, but it was the boy-girl thing and the human aspect of it, Our Tree Named Steve also is up there. They're 2-1 or 1-2 in terms of reception. And here you've got a family. They save a tree from being cut down when they're building a house. The tree pays them back by being this symbol of their home and part of their barbecues that they hang, lights from, or they carve initials of their boyfriends and girlfriends in and hold a hammock. And, when they see it, when they round the corner, that means they're home. And it was, we had that in our house in New Jersey. And when there was one weekend I was there, Robin, my wife, and the three kids were in LA. I was back there. And I think the next week, I changed it a little bit in the book. I say, when you return from grandma's house, what in fact, what it was is they were coming in the next week because Bunny Bunny, the play adaptation of the book, was going to open off Broadway. Okay. So I was there for rehearsals and previews and whatever. Went to sleep one night and there was an electrical storm, and woke up the next day and the tree, Steve, is on the ground. And I knew that it would bother the family when they came in the next week, because he was part of the family, was part of the, you know, the house. It was, you know, he was always there, it was stable. And so I wrote them a letter giving the history of the tree in our family and faxed it to them. But to cushion the blow, I said, you know, we were able to save Steve years ago from being cut down by the builder. There was an electrical storm last night. I couldn't do it. It was Steve's time to go, you know, but just know that he'll always be in our hearts and in our minds. And then in another tree at the other end of the yard, because I had it made into a tree house. And that hits a nerve, you know, it's on a lot of levels, you know, when there are hurricanes and trees go down, I can see, and I don't want, this is not me being mercenary. I'm told that sales, you know, sort of spike because people have trees and parents or grandparents give it to kids who lost their tree. But what I didn't know, what I wasn't conscious of when I was writing the book until the reviews came out and they said, this is a good tool to teach kids about loss, whether it's a pet, a grandparent, or whatever. That person, that pet is still with you. They may look different. Look for them, listen for them. They're still here, they're still with you. And when the initial set of interviews back then came out and they said, and I went, oh yeah, of course, that's what I meant. Oh yeah, that's exactly what I was trying to convey. Baloney, I just wrote this thing and I sent them I faxed the letter to them. By the time they came back, there was a tree house. And I put the letter in a drawer. And years later, I was doing a movie with that I co-wrote with my friend Jesse Nelson. It was called The Story of Us. And I came across this letter. It was in a drawer. And I brought it in one day on set and I showed, I said, look at this letter that I wrote when this tree back home, back in Jersey fell. And she said, that should be a children's book. And I said, wow, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So I drew the pictures and I can't draw. This was ridiculous, okay? Stick figures, you know, very elementary. And I sent it to an agent that I had, very, very powerful agent. And I sent her this book. She wrote back and said, she left a message on my machine. It was really lovely. Alan, you got a problem. The giving tree. And I called her up. I said, well, this is different. This is a symbiotic relationship. I'm not putting down Shel Silverstein's classic at all, but that's the taking kid. The tree's a stump at the end. He keeps on taking stuff from the tree, apples and this and that. I said, this is a different kind of story. I gave it to another agent and she said, okay. I went to Kinko's. She wanted 12 copies of this hand scrawled thing that I wrote. And I sent them to her. She sent them to 12 publishers. The first one accepted it, but they wanted a grown-up to do the drawings. Okay, they didn't want. And I said, gee, you know, unless the grown-up is a Rembrandt, you know, wouldn't this be look more like a letter that was sent to a kid? So she said, okay, let's just wait and see, because you still add to 11 more, all of whom rejected it. Okay, they just said, no, we don't care who draws it, we don't want this. So we got this terrific artist named David Catreau, and who had done a lot of books that were written by my friend Mike Reese, who used to produce The Simpsons. And it's a fascinating kind of a process, because I said, well, what's he like? He said, I never met him. I was under the impression we'd get together, maybe the tree looks like this and the thing like, I couldn't pick him out of a lineup to this very day, okay? So luckily, he saw it the same way. He certainly enhanced whatever my vision was. And here we are, you know?
Yeah. Man, so much to unpack from there. And like what you were saying even before, the story about how people were coming up and saying, this is a good book for, you know, for loss and all that. Because there's different ways you can approach loss to a kid when they're kind of going through things, right? But that book definitely, I think, is a great avenue for you to explore those conversations in a nice way. And again, like I said to you in the beginning, man, there's so many things that I really appreciate your works. But, you know, the story of us, and when my family and I, my wife's from Jersey, and so we were living there, and part of our church, we were part of the, like, these married couples that would help couples with getting ready for marriage and all this other stuff. We did like a full day on Saturdays, like pre-Cana, right? And one of our group members, they used the story of us, like some snippets to show you, like, hey, there's going to be this fun part of marriage.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be this, and you got to be ready for things. So I just want to say, like, you know, from your books to different shows you've written, it, and not that you're thinking about this all the time, but like, it, the way you see life and the way you share it with others in different mediums, man, it's a great way for people to acknowledge, bond, and see certain things that they might not see through their spouse or their kids, or vice versa, see through themselves, right? You can't see the forest through the trees, but if you're a third party observer, you can see some stuff. But the stuff that you write, the stuff, whether it's funny, serious, whatever the case may be, people can attach themselves or see themselves in it, and they can almost define what they might be going through, happy, sad, or whatever. And I'm just saying, like, the thing you were just talking about, all that beautiful story, it's like, there's a lot of things that you do that I'm guessing there's so many different people that are impacted by your stuff that you hardly get a chance to meet. So on all of those, behalf of those people, I just want to say thanks.
Oh, that's really nice of you to say. You know, what I've learned is, if there's a, I'm really touched by what you just said. If there's an element of truth to it, that's just even a little bit relatable, then it becomes about style. Okay, you hook in, and then you take the story this way, you take it that way, whether it's a movie, a play, a book, whatever. But then it's a matter of, like I said, do people like the way that you did it, the way that it was executed? But I think that you need something that's going to grab a little part of your soul, just a little bit. You know, and because I remember when we did The Story of Us, I was riding in a car with Rob Reiner, and I probably had just had a fight with my wife, Robin. And I said, you know, if we ever separate, I think we should do it. This, I'm talking about my wife and I, Rob, if Rob and I ever separate, I think we should do it during a summer, because the kids will be at camp. And they won't know. And they will give us like 2 months to figure things out. And he said, well, what about visiting day? I said, okay. And I'm sure we'll put on a charade. And he said, well, let's see if we can do a movie that has that in there. Okay. So the fact that they show clips of that movie, and I've heard before that there are colleges, social sciences, or a family kind of courses where they show that movie, because we didn't want there to be a seminal moment. Oh, he's cheating on her. Oh, she's the, it's the wear and tear of the job. It's the slow erosion of things. It's the process of life. And how do you keep this alive? You know, because everybody can relate to the very thing that attracted to you to your spouse eventually is going to annoy the chef. You know? I mean, I'll say to Robin, you used to laugh at that. What happened?
Okay. Yep. Been there many times. Love it. I was recently checking out an interview that you, well, it was kind of like a table discussion between you and Martin Short. And you were talking, you know, you mentioned, you know, Gilda Radner and all that, and the different things that you guys would help each other out, and learning about the Saturday Night Live and all that other stuff, and saying like, oh yeah, he came up with that. And, you know, just the bird noise and all that other good stuff. And then the whole mime thing you got from a friend, like, oh yeah, the whole mime thing I thought was hilarious too.
Yeah.
And all the things you've done, but is there something that means a story, a book, a project, movie, Saturday Night Live, whatever, but is there something that kind of means the most to you? And it's kind of tough. It's always like, oh, what's your favorite child? I don't have a favorite child, but it's the middle one. But like, what for you, like, is there one that you're most proud of because of where what it meant to you, where you were in your career, or just the fact that like you could kind of look back and be like, all right, I'm getting to the place where I want to be.
Wow, what a great question. You know, it's so hard to prioritize those
Sure.
things because off the top of my head, I go, well, SNL, first job. You know, I met Gilda, I worked with her and Belushi, and I met my wife on the show. And all of a sudden, I went from slicing lox in a delicatessen to this like Emmy Award in 9 months, you know? So there
Oh,
was
we got
that.
a pay raise from your deli things. I remember he has like how much.
Oh yeah, Lorne asked me how much I have to live on. I said, well, I'm making $2.75, $2.75 an hour. Match it, you know. You know, Bunny was because it was so personal and because it was a way, a cathartic way for me to deal with the death of a friend, you know. So that's really up there. But if I had to choose one thing, there was a book that I wrote called The Other Showman, and it did very well. It was a novel, and it was an autobiographical novel. I made the guy, he owned a stationery store, and but he was going through the same problems. I hate to use the word, the phrase midlife crises because it's hackneyed, but at a point in his life where his marriage was flatlining and his career, the store was flatlining, and it was a fictionalized version of where I was at that particular time. And what I did was I really learned about the novel because it's so internal. You know what I mean? You can go inside the mind of a character. You can the stuff of minutia, like Philip Roth did, or any of the great novelists, you know. The mechanics of the mind and the psyche and the history of a person. And it not only it did well, but it won the Thurber Prize for American Humor. And I was proud of that. And that was certainly a highlight because everything, you know, any other awards that I had won before that, I was part of a team. Okay, a team of writers on SNL, me and Shandling when we did our show. But this was just me. And it wasn't an ego thing as much as it was, wow, I stuck my pen in my heart and it just started writing that way. And it hit, you know?
That's a powerful phrase, and that actually goes right into my next question too. And I know it's probably different for each project, and but when do you feel like you're in the groove of writing? And for each project or something, like, you know, almost like it's comparing it to sports where someone feels like they're in the zone, right? Like that one game between the Bulls and the Trailblazers in the finals when Jordan kept on shooting those threes in a row, and he looks at the, you know, the sidelines like, I don't know what's happening, right? Like for you, and I know it's a little different, but for you, like when do you feel like you're kind of like in the zone of writing whatever project you're on? And is it easier when you're coming up with projects on your own instead of having a deadline, or do you work better under pressure?
Well, that's a great question. Look, I cut my teeth on live TV, so I know the pressure of deadlines. And that's helpful because you learn that look, you got to get it done. Nothing is that precious that you can sit on it or hone it, you know, for the rest of your life, you know. So, you know, there's an adrenaline flow when it's 11 o'clock on Saturday night at NBC and the script isn't ready yet. Well, the audience is coming in. They're here already. We go on the air. Okay, what are we going to do? If you bring that to the theater or bring that to a book, which takes so much longer to write, you realize you get your story down. And then you go back for the jokes. Shandling always talked about, you know, basically you write from the core, and you get, you know, the spine, you get your Christmas tree, and then you hang the ornaments. That's the fun part, you know. As far as knowing when you're in the zone, which is a wonderful question, because this here in New York this summer, because Aaron Judge would go 10 games and hit 10 home runs, and then he'd go the next 10 games and strike out a lot, you know? Yeah. So I know about the zone. I've played ball. You see it all the time. I know that I'm in the zone when I can't sleep. All I want to do is write. When I keep a pad next to me on a passenger seat in the car, there's sort of like you're there. I'm inside the character. This is how I see the world. Leave me, you know, it's really funny. When we got married, Robin would come home. You know, we had this apartment, our first apartment, and she'd come in loaded down with boxes from like Costco, you know, with like 40 rolls of toilet paper, all that stuff that you get at Costco. And she'd see me like this. And she said, "Can you help me?" And I'd go, "Can you see I'm working?" It looked like I was hibernating, but it's such a mental thing that sometimes it has a life of its own and you follow it.
Yeah.
You go, "I don't know when I'm going to feel this way again. I'm going to stick around and, you know, and milk it for everything I can."
Love it. Yeah, that is fantastic. And there's a couple of people that I know who are writers that listen to this are going to soak everything up. One more question before we finish off with the Fatherhood Quick Five. And this might be kind of a weird question, but again, with the people you worked with and just the talented people, and like you said, and even in your life, you'd admit like there's going to be hits or misses. And, you know, I guess people take in art no matter which form it's in their own way. But for you, over your great career, did you work with someone that maybe was ahead of their time or wasn't appreciated, or just the fact that you saw the brilliance in them, but maybe just the way that they were quote unquote packaged didn't get a fair turn?
Wow, what a wonderful question that is. You know, when I first met, look, first of all, Gilda and everybody in the original cast of SNL, it's before they became famous. They were basically off Broadway and a Lampoon show, Lemmings and stuff. It was somewhat off the street, you know? And then, but I would think, you know, look, I knew Billy Crystal since 1974. We used to drive into the city from Long Island and go to Catch a Rising Star and tell our jokes. I was a comic for about 10 minutes. And so I take a lot of pride. Larry David, who I saw back then, you go, wow, this guy is on a, you know, certain people you have a competition with. Most people you do, oh, why didn't I think of that? I would have done it that way, but yes, yes. And then Larry would get up and you go, all right, I'm just going to sit back and enjoy this ride because it was from Mars, you know, and really brilliant. But I think that when I met Shandling, Gary was about ready to break. And I don't think it was so much me, wow, I got to write with him because he's brilliant and I'm going to ride this comet, if you will. What it was an immediate, it was like lightning struck a second time. First time, let's say, with Gilda. And when I met Gary, we just looked at each other and went, oh, we both knew we were in trouble because, you know, when you collaborate, I would say, and I'm being arbitrary with these percentages, 80% of who you are is similar. That's what attracts you to each other, okay?
Yeah.
The other 20% is different. So that makes the alchemy of what you do together something that neither one of you could have done alone.
Yeah.
Okay, it's the synergy of it. And when I first met Gary, you know, I've told this story before, and since there are no rules in terms of language here, I got a phone call from Bernie Brillstein, who managed the two of us. Yeah. He was a legendary manager, and he says, "Do you know?" And I was here in New York. "Do you know who Gary Shandling is?" I said, "Yeah, I've seen him on Letterman. He's funny, you know." And Gary hadn't broken yet, but he was right ready to. He said, "Well, he's doing this a special for Showtime," and Bernie was this real big salty guy that's going to go right in the house if they don't get it. They don't get any help. So I read the script. I thought I could help. They flew me out and I went straight to whatever restaurant, right, from LAX. Met Gary at the restaurant, was seated across the table. He's wearing sunglasses. It's at night inside a restaurant. I'm going, I don't know what he looks like, okay? And during the course of our talking about the script for this special, you know, that they flew me out for, I told him my ideas, and I really couldn't tell from any spatial facial expressions whether I was connecting or not. So, all right, I didn't even know if he liked me. Okay. So he said goodnight, you know, we'll keep in touch and whatever. I went and I checked into whatever hotel. Now, I'm asleep. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. So it's 4 o'clock for my East Coast body. The phone rings in the hotel room. Hello, Alan, it's Gary. I go, yeah, man, what's doing? Alan, my dog's penis tastes bitter. You think it's his diet or what? I went, whoa. I called my wife. I said, I think I found a writing partner. So when you say detecting somebody's brilliance, you know, I couldn't write that joke. Couldn't do that. But I certainly laughed my ass off. I'm going, all right, I'm going to check this out, you know?
Yeah, so good. And another thing too, like everybody comes in to see someone's work of art differently. Like I think a lot of people younger than me will see Gary Shandling. The Gary Shandling show was great. Like that was, I think, to me, kind of like ahead of its time, but like you see Gary Shandling in the Marvel movies, right? Especially like the Iron Man movies, and people are like, oh, that guy's kind of funny or whatever. Like, right. Oh, that's a funny like tertiary character. But you mentioned Saturday Night Live too. Like I grew up watching like Michael Myers, and like the time I remembered it was like Mike Myers and, you know, Adam Sandler. Then you had like Will Ferrell. Like that was mine. But then my parents were like, well, you got to check this out. You got to check out the older version, right? Like right. Cheeseburger, like all of those things where you like respect where Saturday Night Live came from. But just with Gary Shandling, like I think he covers so many different eras. And if people actually kind of go back and quote unquote, like do their own history and like look up if they like this guy for or a woman for like a quick second on stage or whatever, see what they're actually into, and you get the whole piece of work, right?
Oh, yeah. You hit it really on the head, because what he was able to do, and there are very few people, when you think about it, there are a lot of funny people out there, but not that many people create a character that when they talk, they can get a laugh on a nuance because you know who they are. Just like you have friends, oh, you got to imagine so-and-so saying it, okay? He did that like way before us, Jack Benny. Supposedly, the longest laugh in the history of radio was silence. It was on the Jack Benny program, and he had created a character where he was very cheap. And on radio, a guy came up behind him, stuck a gun in his back and said, your money or your life. And the longer he was silent, okay, the bigger the laugh got, because the audience knew that he was weighing the pros and cons. He was considering it. You know, Archie Bunker, you know, if he was coming up the steps of the house and Jefferson, the African-American guy, was sitting in his chair, but Archie didn't know it because he wasn't inside the house yet. You started laughing in anticipation of his reaction. Gary did that.
Yeah. Yep. So good. Well, thank you so much for that. We're going to finish off with a fatherhood quick five. For you, it can be with your, you know, kids or your grandkids. Favorite family movie? Do you guys have one right now?
Oh, man, that's fascinating. One of the kids is sick, and he called up today. He's 9. And my daughter asked my wife, what should we show him? He's home sick from school. And I just said Caddyshack, and because I'm figuring, okay, Animal House is a little bit too dirty for a 9-year-old and whatever. Look, if it's up to me, we'd all be watching The Godfather all the time, okay? But I know that So, you know, I wouldn't have told you Caddyshack yesterday, but it came up maybe a couple of hours ago here, so.
Love it. Favorite musical artist or band you couldn't wait to introduce your kids to?
Oh, the Beatles, hands down. The history of the Beatles, both as a group and it's interesting, as the kids got older, you know, we used to play breakfast with the Beatles on Sunday mornings in the house, and nice. They grew up with that because that was our history. But just like it was with me, I developed an appreciation for George Harrison later on. And I see my kids doing the same thing too.
Nice. Great. Love it. Describe the perfect family vacation. Where would it be?
Oh my. There's a couple of places here on the East Coast that you can rent a cabin, and there's also sorts of outdoor sports, and then there's a dining hall where you can eat. So like a camp situation. I mean, I'm not going to get exotic on us. I'm not going to say, oh, we have to go to Sardinia. I think it's some place where you go and you play ball and you get a little dirty.
Nice. Great answer. Is there someone that you would love to work with on your next project? Like someone you haven't had a chance to work with, but like love to work with him or her?
Wow, that's a great question too. This should be a live person, a person who's alive. Okay. Is that right? I'm a big fan of Tina Fey. I know her a little bit socially, but I look at what she does and I don't know if we would be compatible. I don't know, but I'm going, a lot of people have referred to her as our generation's Elaine May. And, I can see why they say that, given the breadth of her work and all of that. I would like to give that a shot if I ever had the opportunity.
That would be great. And lastly, top three words you hope your kids would use to describe you as a dad, what would you want them to be?
He loved me.
Great, great three words right there. People, make sure you follow Alan on Twitter at Alan Zweibel and also on Instagram at Alan Zweibel Official. And for everything on Alan, go to his website, alanzweibel.com. Sir, it's been such an honor chatting with you. I appreciate your time. I wish you and your family continued success.
Thank you very much to you and yours, and I've had a great time. Thank you
Thank
so
you.
much for having me.
Appreciate it.
I want to thank this week's sponsor, Gladly Family, for sponsoring this week's show. Make sure you support the people who support me. Go to gladlyfamily.com and use the code The Art of Fatherhood for 20% off your order. Like I said before, this podcast is all about trying to prepare new dads for fatherhood, right? Gladly Family is doing the exact same thing. So help out the people that help out this show by supporting Gladly Family over at gladlyfamily.com. And also rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And also go to artoffatherhood.net. You can have a chance to check out some great articles like the weekly Dad's Doing It Right column, the Collector of the Week, and many more. Plus, you have a chance to win some very cool prizes like video games, collectibles, all that good stuff. Go to artoffatherhood.net and please make sure you rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts because that'll greatly appreciate it to get the word out on the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and go to artoffatherhood.net.